Okay, folks, you're listening to Planet Porky, and welcome to the orb that is spinning out there in the Milky Way. And I want to thank you all very much indeed for all the comments and responses we've had to the last Planet Porky. That was when Leslie Ann Jones rejoined me after a short absence. And I'm delighted to say that Leslie Ann Jones is back with me again today. Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed for gracing the studios of Planet Porky. Isn't it nice how many people have been in touch to say how much they enjoyed our last podcast? Agree or disagree, we don't mind. Please get in touch. It's planetporkypod@gmail.com. I gave you the wrong address in the last one, folks, because my mind gets fuzzled and frazzled with anything technical. But it is planetporkypod@gmail.com. Any comments you want to make, go there. Or just text or tweet us. I'm on @MikeParry8. And Leslie Ann, you are?
@LAJWriter.
That's right. We'd love to hear from you. Now, Leslie Ann, in between the last podcast and this one, we were sharing a drink, and you told me this incredible story about Joan Collins, OK? And it absolutely fascinated me. I love Joan Collins. I think she is such a sterling British actress, you know, who's conquered the world, who's conquered American TV, who seems to be indefatigable in her energy and her ability to keep bouncing back. In her 80s now, married to a man, I think, 35 years younger, Percy. But on she goes. But please tell me that amazing story. I've had fears about British Airways for a while now. I think they're going down the tubes a bit. I told you the story. When British Airways first privatised, right, we had a great relationship with them. Nick Lloyd is our editor, Sir Nicholas Lloyd. And the guy who ran the PR there was David Burnside, right? A very fierce Ulsterman. I don't know if you ever came across him, did you?
I didn't.
Yeah, no. Well, anyway, he ran PR there and everything was pro-British Airways. So we got a lot of flights that we could do. And I flew back one time from LA first class. Now, the story that came to mind when we were talking about that was I told you that Joan Collins threw a fit on a flight from LA to London on a British Airways plane because she couldn't get the seat that was always hers, 1A in first class, and there were no first class seats left, and they offered her, you know, two seats in business, but she threw a fit. But the reason she threw a fit, which Jean Rooke told me, the late and great First Lady of Fleet Street, her and Linda Lee Potter used to dominate Fleet Street in their columns in the Express and the Mail respectively. But Jean Rooke said in Comfortable One, she said, no, Joan has to have that seat in 1A because the seat comes with her private bathroom, which she needs for a good hour before the plane lands at Heathrow, because she will never appear in public in case there's a photographer there in anything less than her full slap. Now, you can understand that, presumably.
Quite right, although I don't slap on quite the same amount of slap as Joan. But
yeah,
I did sit next to her on a plane once.
Now, you told me this great story. Please share it with our listeners. It's fantastic.
It's way back. It would have been May 1987.
Yeah.
I was going down for the San Remo Rock Festival.
Right.
She'd just broken up with the Swede, as she called him.
Peter Holm, yeah.
And she was going down to stay with Rod Stewart, your mate.
Oh, really?
To have a little holiday and get over another kind of failed
marriage. Peter Holm apparently was a very well-built man. And that's why Joan, and I'm not, you know, I'm not in any way inferring any particular views about Joan Collins's views about men. I'm getting myself into trouble here.
Yeah,
but
you
anyway,
are.
She apparently liked him a lot. He was very active physically.
Okay,
you know?
Good.
Yes.
Well, the marriage didn't last long, so it couldn't have been that good. But
no.
Anyway, so
Excuse me to interrupt again. The story I read was that when they fell out, Peter would then not let her in the bedroom. He would lock the door and she would have to go to the spare room. It used to drive her mad.
He retained custody of the appendage.
Exactly.
That's what I heard.
Is that right? Yeah, that's the story I heard. But anyway, please, go on. This is a great story.
So I get on the plane and I sit down in my appointed seat and buckle up. And then I look to my right and there is Joan Collins.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, hello.
Hang on. This is a flight to where?
To Nice.
So you were in business?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah. In those days, we were.
Yeah, we were. That's true. Yeah,
just treated very well.
Yeah.
I was going down for work and she was on holiday.
Yes.
So we introduced ourselves and got chatting. And she said, are you feeling all right?
Was she at all standoffish when you first sat down?
No, she was wonderfully friendly. And I was delighted because she's always been a heroine of mine.
Lovely.
Absolutely always looked after
her. Okay,
and admired her look and everything. And said, chat, chat, chat. She says, are you feeling all right? I said, oh, I'm okay. She said, you look a bit peaky, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah.
And she said, I hope you don't mind me saying, are you pregnant?
Mm.
And I said, well, no, I don't think so.
Were you married at the time?
I wasn't.
Right.
And
did you have a regular boyfriend at the time?
Yeah, I did. And
right,
I didn't have any reason to suspect that I might be. But
right.
She said, trust me, my dear, I'm an absolute witch about these things.
Yes.
And I've predicted several pregnancies in my life.
Really?
And I can assure you
yeah.
that I think you will find you are. And lo and behold, she was right.
Good God.
So she actually told me I was pregnant before I knew.
Yeah. That is absolutely amazing. And did you keep up the relationship with Joan Collins
saw
once you got
her,
off the plane?
She attacked a photographer on the flight. She attacked this photographer.
Why was someone trying to sneak a picture of
her? Came running up the plane
and
just started snapping her wildly with one of those gigantic cameras that they used to carry in those days.
Yes.
She wasn't having this. She shoved me out into the aisle.
Mm.
Excuse me, she said, and she got up. And she shouted at this man, and she demanded the film, as we used in those days.
Yeah.
She said, how dare you take my picture on a flight without asking my permission?
Yes.
Give me the film.
Yeah.
And he refused.
Yes.
At which point, stewardesses started arriving. There was a bit of a fracas.
Yeah.
And collectively, they forced this man to rip the film out of his camera and give it to her.
Well, that would be, again, from what I just told you about the fact that she hadn't got necessarily all the right makeup on and all that kind of stuff. Very aware of her image, yeah?
She didn't have much makeup on, you're right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
she also hadn't had any facelifts at that point.
Right.
She may have done subsequently, but at that point when people were saying, she's had the lot,
actually
she had a normal number of wrinkles for a woman that the age she would have been, what, 50-ish?
Early 50s
at that time,
like that. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
I think she's fabulous. I won't have a word said against her.
No, I won't either. I met her once at Nick Lloyd's 50th birthday party. The Daily Express building was not very far from our studios here, just round the corner at the end of Blackfriars Bridge.
I remember, I worked there.
That's, of course, yeah. And for those people who are lucky enough not to have to live in London or work in central London, Blackfriars Bridge, of course, connects North London to South London, near Waterloo and Blackfriars, and that's where the Daily Express... Do you know what? It's so poignant. We went into that building 35 years ago, right, when it was new, moving out of Fleet Street. So I was the last news editor in Fleet Street, and the chair in Fleet Street, the famous news editor's chair, right, the first in the new building, and 35 years later, from the windows of TalkSport offices, I saw the bulldozers move in and start knocking down the second building. So I saw Fleet Street end, and the building's not knocked down. It's a protected building called the Black Nubianca, but it was renovated. And then the second express building I worked in, I've seen that knocked down in front of my very eyes.
A waste of a building as well.
Well, they're going to put something better there. You know, that's the whole thing these days. They're going to build up apartments.
Why not build to last, as we did in
you'd hope so. TalkSport, I worked in the original offices in Oxford Street. That's where we started when Talk Radio was the company we bought and turned into TalkSport. We then moved to not very far again from here. In fact, just down a road called Hatfields on the other side of Blackfriars Road, funnily enough. And I walked past there the other day. That's now closed down, of course, and we've moved to the spectacular London Bridge location, the baby, what's the huge one called? Shard, the baby Shard.
The baby Shard.
So the Shard is right next to us. That's the biggest building in London. And the baby Shard is half the size next to it, and we're in there now. So I've seen a lot of offices.
You've been up the Shard.
Yeah, I've been right to the top.
I went recently for the first time.
In our first time we moved into our offices, the management of News Corp, who own us, it's News actually, it's called News UK now, it was near Christmas, through a Christmas party, invited everybody in the new building. The party was on the third floor from the top, but with special permission, we were taken up in groups of 10, to the very, very top open gallery at the top of the Shard, where there is no roof. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
if you look at the Shard, look at the top of it, it looks like it's unfinished at
the
top.
Like a little crown, it looks.
Yeah, like a little crown like that. They've got false glass grass on the floor, and you can sit there and have a drink. I mean, the wind howls in, but it's the most spectacular view in London. You know, it's fabulous.
I took the kids up to Hutong, the Chinese restaurant up there,
for
their birthday in August.
Yeah. What kind of floor is it? It's 35th, maybe. Oh, yeah, sounds brilliant. It's beautiful. I bet it is.
But I say to all visitors now who come to London who want to go up,
yes,
go during the day because you get better photographs.
Yes.
If you go up at night, yes, yeah, it looks lovely.
No, but it's just sparkly
lights. Your
pictures
aren't going to come out unless you've got, you know,
no,
a camera with, yeah, a proper shutter or something.
No, I totally agree. It's sparkly lights. Right, OK, got off the... We diverted there a bit, talking about offices. That's very interesting to our millions of listeners. But again, I want to concentrate on the famous people with you, Leslie Ann, because, of course, you've met them all. Great story, that, about Joan Collins. Did you ever meet Elizabeth Taylor?
No, I was too young to, yeah, that party.
Even I was too young, actually, because, yeah, when I first got over to America, she was doing all that mad stuff with Michael Jackson, you know. And
they became best friends, didn't they?
They became best friends.
The thing they had in common was that both were child stars.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And they sort of found
that's
each other because of that.
Good point.
And Liza Minnelli was another who he befriended.
Yes.
And he did kind of zone in on people who,
yeah, that's right,
who'd had very dysfunctional
who'd had
childhoods,
same,
like him.
Same sort
so
of upbringing.
So they had that in,
yeah,
common. It,
yeah,
was,
sure,
a really important thing.
Sure. But anyway, listen, I tell you what, you might know a bit more about this one. I love these stories about 60s rock stars. I mean, you weren't around in the 60s, but you know a lot of the rock stars who were. So how about this then? So what happens is there's a church in Chelsea. It's near Cheyne Walk and it's fallen to pieces. He wants to raise money. All of a sudden, this donation of £650,000 arrives and it's to buy a new organ, and half of it's been paid for by Mick Jagger, who has a house nearby.
Number 48, Cheyne Walk.
Is that right?
I've been there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, you tell me about that in a minute. And the other £325,000 came from Eric Clapton, who apparently also has a house in Chelsea.
Well, they're all for preserving organs, these rock stars.
Are they? Are they? Are they?
If you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, that's a bit smutty, Leslie Ann, and I thought better of you. But yes, I know exactly what you mean. In one way or another, they do want to preserve organs.
It's an instrument, you know, and it's a classic old instrument.
Of course it is.
Why wouldn't they want to preserve something like that?
Absolutely. Jagger 76 and Clapton 74 both have homes a mere Bible's throw away from the Chelsea old church.
Nobody throws a Bible.
No, exactly. Have quietly donated to the appeal. It's a Grade 1 listed building. It overlooks the Thames. So, tell me about your encounter in Mick Jagger's home in Chelsea.
Well, I went there to interview him in the 80s.
Right.
He's generally there during the winter months, but only...
Well, how many houses has Mick got?
He's got a house on Spaghetti Beach in Mystique. I've been there as well.
Right. I know he's also got two townhouses knocked together in... Manhattan.
Yes, I was about to say.
Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah,
go
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
Do you know where it's not Greenwich Village, is it?
No, I haven't been there.
But I think it's down that way.
No. Mm. And of course, he's got the house on Richmond Hill, which he and Jerry shared.
Yes, that's right.
But when Gabriel, their youngest child, came of age,
yes,
Jerry had to give her half back. So it was only really on loan.
Yes.
A very close friend of mine was Jerry's PA for some years.
Oh, yes.
So I got all the gossip.
Oh, good.
For quite a few years.
Yes.
And Mick is very tight. He's
what, despite his wealth?
Extremely parsimonious,
yeah,
person.
Yeah.
He once asked my friend to go looking for a flat for,
yes,
Gabriel, his son, and he gave her a budget of £225,000 in, well, Notting Hill.
I was about to say, in Nottingham, but not in Notting Hill.
She said, yeah, you're not even going to get a broom cupboard, Mick, for
Notting
Hill.
No.
But he wanted to know the price of every nail, every screw,
really,
every last little bit of wood.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
She had to account to him.
Golly, that's amazing. You say they're parsimonious, but... When you mentioned Rod Stewart earlier, when we went up to Glasgow with Rod in his plane, private planes, lovely. I mean, fabulous. You know,
you couldn't do that now without being criticised for your carbon footprint.
No, I don't suppose you could. No, but you know, what a tremendous privilege, and what a great guy he was. You know, very very normal.
Yeah, we
man.
Love Rod. We love Rod.
Yeah, but so on that day before he came back, he was getting a lot of grief. He took his two little boys with him. He's devoted to them, and you know, he takes them everywhere. Even when he now appears in America, he flies home every night. He does seasons in Las Vegas, but he flies home to his home in Los Angeles after every performance.
We need to talk to him about his carbon footprint then, don't we?
Well, I think carbon footprint...
Mac has been doing that for years, by the way.
Yeah, he has.
He and Linda always flew back.
Was that right?
Between wings gigs,
Okay. So anyway, the point of my story is, so we go up there, and then after the game, of course, when you've got a private plane, you take off any time you like. Rod said we've got to go over to the Nike store and get a new pair of Nike trainers for one of the boys. It was a birthday or something like that. But he swore us to absolute secrecy in the people carrier we were travelling in that we must not tell Penny how much they cost, because she was adamant, right, and I'm not giving any secrets away here because we have talked about it so on radio, that she put a budget on how much they were allowed to spend on their shoes, and she wasn't going to allow them to spend, you know, excessive amounts.
Hang on a minute. Who earns the money in that marriage?
Well, I don't know, and I don't know what the relationship is between the two.
Why would you be imposing a budget? That's crazy. Well, so how much can a pair of trainers really cost?
Well, they were over £200, the pair that we were looking for, okay?
Okay.
But the point of the story is that you say, you know, mixed mean and all that. That might be extraneous pressures. Rod was under, you know, a three-line whip from Penny. You must not spend over this man money. And I mean, I'm breaking a secret here, really, I suppose. But eventually, he went over the budget and all that. But we were sworn to secrecy. And I tell you what, it's an amazing thing in Glasgow. So you imagine Glasgow. Imagine downtown Glasgow. You know, normal people. We get out the people carrier, and I walked into the shop first. And there's some young lad there working on a Sunday in the Nike shop, you know, aged about 18. And he looked at me first, and then he looked over my shoulder, and the bloke behind me looked a lot like Rod Stewart, you know. And he sort of stopped, then he looked again. And then Rod, who was in a hurry, pushed past me and said, "I want a pair of so-and-so size, have you got them?" And before the bloke could say anything else, he was sent off to the storeroom to get them, but still wasn't quite sure whether he had Rod Stewart in his shop or not, you know, or Sir Rod Stewart, of course, as he is. And it was amazing the effect Rod had on, I mean, in the football ground, we were in the executive suite, so everybody kind of knew him, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But everywhere else, people fainted at the sight of Rod Stewart, you know. Very, very famous man, but very, very easygoing.
Very down to earth. I interviewed him once. Do you remember when Terry Wogan had his nightly chat show?
Yes, I do.
On TV, and they filmed it at the Shepherd's Bush studio, which...
Where I've done a live show.
The little theatre.
The O2 theatre.
Yes, so you have.
Yes.
So I had to go backstage and do the interview before he went on live on TV.
Yeah, sure.
And he had a red and white stripe, very wide stripe, Turnbull and Asser shirt.
Right.
In a packet.
Who was this?
Rod.
Rod, yeah.
And he had it in the packet. He'd just bought the shirt.
Right, yeah.
So while we were chatting, preliminaries,
yeah.
He was pulling out the shirt, pulling out all the pins, the little plastic clips, the bits of cardboard, all the stuff inside the shirt packaging. Got the shirt, rolled it up into a ball, and went to me, "Sit on that." So for the duration of the interview, I had to sit on his shirt so that it would look all crumpled up and not like he just bought it. So he was going to put that on and go on to speak to Terry Wogan.
Golly.
So when I watched him on the programme, all I could think was, five minutes ago, I was sitting on your shirt.
On the shirt, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Not many people can say that.
No, they can't say that. Is that amazing that some of his backroom staff had not provided him with a shirt? Would that be the same show that George Best appeared on, Blind Drunk?
Maybe it was.
No, it was. It was.
I was blinded by Rod.
I bet you were. The very same show. What happened was we were in the Daily Express newsroom in the new building around the corner from here, which has now been knocked down. And George Best came in. He was absolutely bladderated. I mean, completely. And he could hardly speak. And he started talking about, "I like screwing, you know, is anybody around here worth screwing Terry and all that?" It was a live show from that theatre. So they couldn't cut it, couldn't stop it, they couldn't delay it. Didn't do it in delay. On radio, mostly you get like a 7-second delay, sometimes 14 seconds, you know. No delay here, it all went out. And of course, the BBC were massively criticised next day because it transpired they'd got George to the theatre 2 hours before the show and just left him in the green room with a free bar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what do they think they're playing? Anyway, just one last thing. Ever run into Eric Clapton?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Right.
I've been to his house.
Oh, yeah?
Down in Surrey. Had an incredible...
Kenley, is it? Kenley in Surrey, something like that?
The
name
I think of the place is quite gone.
Yeah.
It's ages ago, but he had a proper... I can't really say American Indians, because America wasn't invented when the Indians populated. Native American. Totem pole.
Oh, yeah.
A full-size totem pole in his front garden.
Right.
Yeah. Which was impressive. But,
it is, yeah.
But yeah, there's various bits of film kicking around of George Harrison visiting him there when they were still in the Beatles and so on.
That's right.
And he kept that same house all that time.
Yeah, I think he still got it.
The house looked very familiar to me when I'd been there. Oh. And of course, I'd seen it on film, hadn't I?
Still got it. Last picture I saw of Eric Clapton, he was in a washerette in New York in the early hours of the morning.
Ewhurst is where it is.
Ewhurst, that's right.
In beautiful place.
Yeah, you're right. Good old Eric Clapton, old slow hand. Given up drink 30 years ago and stuck with it. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you for the once again for all the responses we get to doing the show. Now, it's a lovely story here I want to tell you about Leslie Ann, and Leslie Ann Jones, of course, is with me, and it almost turned me to tears, and it's going to turn you to tears when I tell you about it. It's about a female farmer who rears sheep, and she sent the sheep to you know, to slaughter, basically, because the point of raising sheep is it's a business, and everybody goes on about, you know, animals' rights and all that. Sheep only exist because we need lamb and we need wool. Do you see what I mean? We need lamb to eat, we need, you know, and we need wool to make clothes. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any purpose to the sheep. But what happened here is this: so she rears all these sheep, and then after about, I don't know, a few months, the sheep grow up, and a bloke comes along, and they go to auction, and the sheep are auctioned, and then they go off, and they go to be slaughtered, you know, for the food process and the wool and all that. Anyway, let me read this story too, because it tells it perfectly. The bond between Melanie McLean and Norman was too strong for anybody to put asunder. The crofter from Benbecula, I've been to Benbecula, believe it or not, I went there to do a story about a bear that escaped. There's this bloke in the Highlands, he keeps a bear as a pet, him and his wife. I mean, literally.
Is that legal in this country?
Well, he does, anyway. Oh, okay. He keeps this bear, you know, in the grounds of their, you know, their small holding and
lots
all that kind
of
stuff.
Lots of wives live with bears, though, don't they?
Sorry?
Lots of wives live with bears.
Well, I suppose so, yeah. But this bear jumped into the sea one day and swam off and and ended in Benbecula. But anyway, it's another story. The crofter from Benbecula in the Outer Hebrides knew she could not live without the little sheep and embarked on a 540-mile round trip to bring him back. Basically, what had happened was the sheep was rejected by his mother, so she'd hand-reared this sheep, you know, with plastic bottles full of milk and all that kind of stuff. But then the sheep went off to auction with all the other sheep. Mm. But then she started getting these terrible pangs of guilt and all this kind of stuff. So
did she become a vegetarian at this point?
I don't think she did. She decided last month to sell Norman, that's the name of this little sheep, okay, who was rejected by his mother, among others in her flock at a market in Loch Maddy on the neighbouring island of North Uist. Or Uist. She had misgivings even as she did so, but went through with the sale because other farmers told her, oh yeah, we've all had feelings like that, don't worry, you'll soon get over it, right? Norman, a Suffolk lamb, was picked up by Irene, 66, and Jim Fowley, 69, from the 600 sheep they'd sent to auction after a 540-mile journey to get him back. They simply could not let him go, and he is now their pet, okay? Isn't that amazing?
It's quite a common phenomenon. This.
Is it?
Yes, because this is known. Okay, so you're a farmer. You send your sheep off to the slaughterhouse.
Yes. How do you know all this? Because you were brought up in Wales, of course.
Because I read stuff. You know,
right.
Yeah,
okay.
I was brought up in Wales.
Right.
I was. And so the animals become very stressed on the journey in the trucks because they sense, they know that they're going off, and they know their fate.
Yes.
They know what's waiting for them.
Yes.
And they become very agitated.
Right.
And it would take a completely hard-hearted human being to not feel empathy
with those
animals. Yeah, but I mean,
if sheep farmers went around rescuing all the sheep that they suddenly formed an emotional bond with,
I agree.
No sheep would go to slaughter and we wouldn't have any lamb on our plates.
Famously, Paul McCartney and Linda, back in the 70s, when they had their farm up in Mull, and they were having Sunday lunch.
That's right.
And they were eating from a leg of lamb at the table, watching their lambs gambling away in the
field,
outside.
That's right, yeah.
And they all put down their knives and forks and said, we can't eat this anymore because we love watching them.
I know.
The whole family became vegetarian.
Yeah.
I was with Paul up in the Liverpool Institute of Performing
Arts
in the summer.
Yes.
I was his guest. Mm. We were chatting away in the green room. He is 76 years old.
Yes.
He is the finest advert for vegetarianism I have ever seen.
Sure.
The man looks 50.
Sure.
So, there's a message here.
Well, there may be a message, and you may be absolutely right. He wrote a song on the first LP he made when he broke from the Beatles was just called McCartney, which I've got a copy of.
Me too.
And the second one with an orange and sort of blue cover and all sorts of pictures on it, including McCartney holding a sheep.
It's Ram. That's one of my favourite albums.
Ram on. But the song on that was one horse, one sheep, are going to get me a good night's sleep, looking for a home in the heart of the country.
Great song.
He became
great album.
Yeah, great album, I agree. He became a country boy. Anyway, this is what's so moving about it, right? Mrs. McLean recalls arriving at the farm where the sheep had gone after they were auctioned, right? Hang on, Mr. Glenn, inform police. And, right. Right, she'll arrive at the farm to meet Mr. Fowley, who was the farmer who had bought them. She did not know whether Mr. Fowley would sell the sheep back to her. The little sheep, what's his name again?
Norman.
Norman, who she wanted to bring back. She said, he took me to the 75-acre field where Norman was grazing with 700 other sheep.
How did she recognise Norman?
Well, this is the point. While many people would struggle to tell one lamb from another, it was not a problem for me. She said, as soon as I walked into the field, Norman recognised me and he ran like a bullet towards me.
No way.
She said, tears were pouring from my eyes. I couldn't believe that I'd nearly let Norman go to slaughter, you know? She said he was the smallest of a set of triplets when he was born. Sheep normally shouldn't have more than two. That's like a mother sheep, shouldn't have two. Because they struggle to feed them. They have to have their mother's milk within the first 6 hours or the newborn will die. He was very, very weak when he was born and couldn't stand or lift his head. We kept him under a heat lamp. He gradually got better and he got stronger. I fed him milk from a bottle. I knew he'd been fine. He was intentionally sold, but I didn't have a wink of sleep afterwards. It was such a dilemma. As I got to the market, he went out with the others, but he just stood beside me. He had to be dragged away from me to be sold at auction. There were other crofters there who swayed me and said, don't worry, you've just got to make a decision. She said, it's a very male environment, and I can only assume none of them had the maternal feelings that I had for Norman. I just went with it. People were saying, don't be so silly. We've all had that sort of thing. You'll get over it. But I instantly regretted it. This wee little guy was totally different. He was like a dog to me. Anyway, when she got to the other farmer, I thought if I gave myself a week or two, I'd get over it, but I didn't. I was a little embarrassed about having to phone the farmer who'd bought the sheep, but I just had to do it. And she said afterwards, the farmer just gave her the Norman back, and Norman is now a family pet and will remain there until he dies.
Well,
isn't that lovely story?
The farmer hadn't eaten it. There is a precedent here. Do you remember that film City Slickers with Billy Crystal?
Yes, I do.
Years
yes.
and years ago, one of my favourite films. And the city boys go off and they go on a cattle drive.
Yes.
And they become cowboys for a week.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And he brings back to his family in Seattle a calf called Norman.
Oh, right.
So maybe
okay.
that's where she got the name from.
Yeah, maybe.
But people do tend to anthropomorphise animals. And
do they? That's a very big word.
Lending human qualities to animals.
Writer,
well,
you know,
of course.
Shakespearean.
I do know words of more than three syllables,
Well, of course
but,
you do.
I think that's quite a dangerous precedent for her.
Well, I don't. I think it's lovely. And it's a great story. It reduced me to tears when I first read it.
There are animals.
I'm going to show you a picture
over.
Of Norman. It'll reduce you to tears as well. Look at little Norman there. His little black face.
Yeah, he's very cute.
And out of 700 sheep, she would have recognised him.
Because he's got a black head.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe.
Maybe that's the reason.
Do most sheep not have a black head?
No, most of them don't.
Well, it's a black face, not a black head,
face,
is it?
Yeah,
black face. Well, I think all sheep have black faces. I know.
No, they don't.
You could be right. Could be right, yeah. Anyway, listen, I'll tell you what I want to talk to you about, right? Just recently, I've been getting a bit of skin rash. I don't know why, but now my problem is, because I've now become the face of television as well as radio, I now have an image of a silver beard, okay?
It's all that makeup they stick on you.
Maybe
it
is.
Are you cleaning it off properly afterwards?
That's a very good point, but they don't usually put it in your beard, you know what I mean?
Okay, it's a little bit of eczema or psoriasis.
Well, it could be something like that. So anyway, for years I've suffered that on my hands, if you can see between my fingers there.
It's common for it to migrate to the face.
Is it, really?
Yeah, in old
but
age.
I've got this great cream called Humavate, which I have tubes and tubes of it at home. I buy it all the time, you know. And I rub it on at night before I go to bed, and it's very good. It goes within a day, you know, and it only flares up about every 3 or 4 months or something.
Stress usually causes
is it. Is it? Yeah,
that's it. It runs in my family as well.
Is that right? Yeah, okay. So, anyway, I thought, you know, I wonder if there's anything better, because the problem with the human bait is it's okay on your hands, but it's very thick jelly.
Yeah, it's,
and put it in your beard, it looks awful and all that. So there I was trying to sort of work out what I could do. And I came across, believe it or not, the latest fad amongst predominantly women for a face cream, a moisturiser, which costs £205 a tube.
Suckers.
£205 a tube.
Us are suckers.
It's called The Cream, right?
Yeah.
Do you know about it?
I've read about it, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why it's so good at keeping your skin dermatologically and biologically good is because it's been invented by a surgeon who has spent his life healing burns.
Yeah, yeah. There's been a few of those. Do you remember Crème de la Mer?
No.
That was all the rage a few years ago, and it's a fortune.
Oh, yeah, it's here. Yeah, sorry.
Similarly priced.
Crème de la Mer, £125 a tube, allegedly invented by Dr. Max Huber, who created the renewing cream after burning his skin in a lab accident.
That's right. And there's algae extracts and all that kind of thing. There are lots of these so-called miracle creams on the market.
Yeah.
The man I was married to,
yes,
his cousin, he's still a very good friend of mine. Right. I attended his mother's funeral quite recently.
Right, okay.
And he's a professor of dermatology.
Right.
And he knows more about skin. He's recently published a book about the skin of the penis, and this was his life.
Oh, really?
This was his life's work.
Oh my God!
Oh, 20 years to write this book.
Yeah.
Fascinating book.
Yeah.
Knows so much about skin.
Yeah.
And he says there is nothing we can apply to our dermis, to our external skin, that is going to improve any damage that's already been made.
Right.
So there isn't anything. The whole point about
You can't repair skin, basically.
You can't. To a point, you can.
Yeah.
I've been using bio oil on my cancer scar on my arm, and it's reduced.
Right. Okay.
But it's still there. Yep. It's always going to be there.
Yeah.
So the important thing with skin is regular cleansing, toning, and moisturising. It doesn't matter if you use something out of Superdrug, or if you go down Harrods and buy the whole Crème de la Mer range or this new stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you spend £500 or a fiver.
Really?
The effect is the same. It's the regularity of keeping.
I thought I might get a tube of this.
Yeah,
No.
Don't waste your money. Buy me another tube.
Beta. And well, I need to get it done because the problem is, I don't want flaky skin under my beard.
Okay.
I can't get rid of my beard. If I do, I get excuse me.
I know what
get
you
rid
mean.
Of my look. If you
I don't
what
have
mean.
A beard, of course,
yeah,
but I know what you mean. So what I would advise you use is Elizabeth Arden 8-Hour Cream.
Oh really?
Which is a wonderful product.
Is it
relatively inexpensive?
Does it moisturise?
It does everything.
Right.
You can use
Elizabeth
it on
Arden
your nails.
What?
8-hour cream.
8-hour cream. No, I must try
and
that.
You can buy that in Boots as well.
Just read a bit about this one.
Yeah,
this did fascinate
You're
me.
You're a bit sold on this, aren't you?
I am. The Cream Command is the definitive... The Cream Commands. It's called The Cream.
The Cream.
It's by Augustinus
It's a bit unimaginative as a name, isn't it?
And it says The Cream Commands the definitive article because it is apparently the definitive face cream, matching price tag, palpitation inducing, £205 for 50 millilitres. Since it launched quietly last year, The Cream has become a cult product, slowly acquiring celebrity fans Demi Moore, Naomi Campbell, Victoria Beckham, Amber Valletta, Courtney Cox, Carla Bruni, Kate Bosworth and Leonardo DiCaprio have all enthused about it publicly. Now,
Leonardo
they can't
DiCaprio,
all be wrong,
by
can
the
they?
Way.
Hey?
Well, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Yes, they can be wrong.
Yeah.
You remember Trini of Trini and Susanna?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, she's with Charles Saatchi now, isn't she? Nigella's ex.
That's right.
And she's launched a cosmetic range.
Yes.
One of the products, which is her breakthrough product, is called Miracle Blur.
Yeah.
And it was sold out everywhere. You could not get this. The website crashed. There were queues to get this stuff. It's £26.
Yes.
How do I know? Because I bought one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a little tiny pot of stuff.
Yeah.
You put your makeup on.
Yeah.
And then with your little finger, you dab this on into all your wrinkles.
Yes.
And it blurs out the wrinkles.
Right.
This is said to be the miracle product.
Right.
All these people are raving about it. So I buy one.
Mm.
Does it work?
No.
Absolutely not.
Well, that's amazing.
I'm a complete mug for having gone and spent my £26 on that.
That's,
of course it doesn't work.
See, that's amazing. Because,
none of it works.
Because this guy, I mean, he's really sold it. He says, epigenetics is what I studied, and that is why I've come up with a product now which can treat everything. He recommends using the cream for everything. This is Professor Bader, right?
Mm.
He says, cleansing, exfoliating, removing makeup, washing up, all right. Not washing up, but the idea of rinsing this precious stuff off my face feels just as profligate. I might as well poke fivers down the plug, says one person who tested it.
Yeah.
So once you put it on, you don't want to wipe it off again or take it off because it's so expensive. Now, you'll see at the end of my nose here, right?
This is another.
You see, when a man gets to my age...
Yeah.
You don't care what your face looks like. I'm not expecting to be picked up, you know, by some glamorous blonde the next time.
You do care, because you let them put makeup on you to do television, so you do care.
Ah, but I hadn't finished what I was going to say.
I'm sorry.
You don't care what you look like in the normal day of life.
Okay.
And as I've done radio most of my life, or newspapers, I don't really care if my skin starts to get wrinkled, if it flakes, or it doesn't matter. I don't care if I walk into a bar and barmaid gives me a funny look because, you know, I've got a big nose or something like that. But since I've started doing television, I've suddenly realised I've got to look after my skin. Mm. And, you know, you're absolutely right, by the way. You can cover most things up in the makeup room of an ITV studio, ITN studio, which I work at. And they'll put it, and they'll, like, I've got a blob on the end of my nose. Can you see it? A
I
white
can
blob.
Now that you pointed out.
Yeah, and that white blob is a cancerous bubble, right? Okay. But it's non-malignant. I've had it tested. And I had to have two stitches put in it after I got it tested. I got it tested to find out what it was.
Yeah.
And it needs removing.
Okay.
But the problem is, to remove it, it's not malignant, so it's not spreading or anything like that. But to get it done properly, I would have to have a plaster on my nose for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, because I now have a face for television, I can't have a plaster on my face for two weeks.
So you have to take a holiday and do it during the holiday?
No, it's easier to get the makeup girls just to put the makeup over my face, honestly.
Okay, okay.
And I prefer it that way. I mean, you know, when you get a break in television at the at my stage of my career, I ain't going to start turning it down, you know?
Okay, so, I go with that.
Yeah, exactly. So, thank you very much for the recommendation.
We could go halves on a tube of this stuff and just conduct our own experiment, if you want. Well, or we could have another couple of Bloody Marys down the road.
Well, another couple of Bloody Marys sounds pretty
good. Go on, then.
Right, okay, folks, you have been listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much for joining myself and Leslie and Jones. I just want to say that if you want to get in touch, it's planetporkypod@gmail.com. A couple of podcasts ago, I gave you the wrong address on that one because I'm not very good. I'm on Mike Parry 8 and Leslie Ann Jones, you're on
LAJ Writer.
That's right. Send us your views on what you've been listening to today. Thank you very much for joining us. And we will be back with you again very soon. I'm not.